Welcome back to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember back in the early 60s? Well, when we had math grads fresh out of school, well, they found there weren't a lot of job openings for what we call them mathematicians. But companies working those newfangled gizmos called computers would take just about any grad who walked into the doors. Computer science was still in its infancy, but around that time, my next guest enrolled in a small computer science program at Stanford University. She and the other students worked on those hulking mainframe computers. Remember them? Remember those stacks of punch cards not to be folded, spindled, or mutilated? Huh? Remember that phrase? In 1968, she became the first woman to get a Ph.D. in computer science. Her thesis was a program to play chess and games. She tackled lots of other computing challenges since then, and this week, she won the Turing Award. That's what is called the Nobel Prize in Computing, and she's here to talk about that long road less traveled. And if you'd like to talk with her, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We're also Twittering. You can tweet us your questions by writing the at sign. That's followed by SciFry. Also taking your questions in Second Life. Let me introduce my guest. Barbara Liskov is an institute professor and head of the Programming Methodology Group in the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. She joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Liskov.
Thank you very much.
You know, I think that most of us would imagine that being a woman in those days was in the computing department was a long and lonely career. Would that be correct?
I didn't feel particularly lonely. When I first started at Stanford, we had a very small class, and the students typically worked as a group to work on the class projects. Later, when I joined MIT, I felt that I was accepted as a faculty member just like everybody else.
How did you get into computers? You had a bachelor's degree in math.
Just in the way that you described it, I got a job as a programmer when I couldn't get an interesting job as a mathematician, and I discovered that I had a talent for it. And after a couple of years of working, I decided to go back to graduate school so I could learn more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Were there many courses in computing in those days?
There were only a few places in the country that had programs in computer science. One of them was Stanford University, and that's where I decided to go for graduate school.
Mm-hmm. When you got your first programming job, how did you know what to do? Was it more or less just trial and error in those days?
I was handed a reference manual for the programming language. That was Fortran.
I remember that one.
Yes, and a description of the project. And I just had to figure out what to do by myself.
So you sat there and said,
Yes, exactly.
Well, those are the days if you handed in your I remember from those days in the 60s, if you punched out a bunch of those punch cards and you had a mistake in a period, it wouldn't compile and run. You had to wait forever to get them back and rerun them again.
That's right. Yes, you had to do batch processing. One advantage of that way of doing things versus what happens today is you did think a little more carefully about what you wanted to accomplish if your program managed to get through the compiler.
Yeah.
And so in a way, it was perhaps a more efficient process as far as your own time was concerned.
Yeah, because you cared about eating in those days. If you didn't,
right? You cared about, yes.
Yes, if it didn't run, you had to wait there again and do it all over again.
Yeah.
There were no keyboards and things.
You had to if you wanted to punch your own card, you had to use one of those special machines to punch them in.
Yeah. Actually, that was my first science fair project. I wrote a program that could read a punch card. Made a little object that could do that. So you were actually back in the 60s then. You and your colleagues were basically essentially creating the whole field. There wasn't a lot of earlier work to build on.
That's true. There wasn't much earlier work.
Mm-hmm. So do you sit around and think, well, what can I do with a computer?
That kind of thinking for me came a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
First, you know, you start as a graduate student and you're working on projects that your advisor has in mind.
Right.
And you're thinking about what can I do within that context.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got my PhD, I worked at the MITRE Corporation, and there I worked on a project that they had in hand.
Right.
But when I got to MIT, then it changed completely. I had to, you know, think all by myself about what I was going to work on next.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to develop the language yourself that you were working on, the computer language?
The first research project I did at MIT involved in inventing a computer language called CLU, C-L-U. Mm-hmm. And that was part of my early work on data abstraction, which is the thing I'm most well known for.
Tell us what that means.
What that means is it's a way of providing modules with very narrow interfaces. It's a way of separating the idea of what you're trying to accomplish with a piece of code mm-hmm. from how you do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you decide to re-implement things in a different manner, it's not going to affect any of the rest of the program, which only depends on what you're doing, not how you're doing it.
Oh, that's a very important thing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Are there more women in programming today compared to when you started?
Actually, there aren't. When I started, because of what you said in your introduction, nobody had a background in computer science, and they would take anybody on who had the ability to do programming. Today, of course, you have to have a degree in computer science, and so there's a sort of a set of obstacles in the way. You have to go to a university and get a degree in computer science or some related field, and for reasons that are not entirely well understood, the girls have not entered that program at the rate at which you would have thought they might have.
Mm-hmm. So things are well. The more they change, the more what?
Well, they've stayed flat for many years. Mm-hmm. I do believe they might be changing at this point. I've seen at MIT in the last couple of years that the number of women in our undergraduate major has gone up mm-hmm. from maybe around 20% to somewhere between 25% and 30%.
Mm-hmm. We got a tweet here from Craig Newmark of Craigslist, who wants to say hello to you, or says hello because he remembers looking at CLU and it says looking at no longer technical at Craigslist makes me sad.
Uh-huh.
So there you go. So what do you say to women today who are looking to get into computer science?
It's a great field.
Yeah.
And it requires a certain way of doing things, which if it happens to be something that you enjoy and are good at, it's a great field to go into.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it opens up many other things. Our undergraduate majors don't all go into technical professions. Sometimes they become doctors or lawyers, patent attorneys, mm-hmm. business. A lot of them used to go into finance before mm-hmm. the recent problems.
Well, that was my next question. Are people staying away from Wall Street now?
I suspect, but I don't have any firsthand knowledge, that our graduates are a little less likely to go to Wall Street right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't blame Wall Street on the graduates then?
No, I certainly would not.
1-800-989-8255. Someone wants to know who the Turing Award is named after.
It's named after Alan Turing. He did some very early fundamental work in computer science, and he's also very well known for his work on breaking codes during World War II. He was a British citizen, and he worked with the code breakers, and there was a book of that name that was published
right.
about his life.
Yeah, didn't he make some rules to judge whether a computer was intelligent or not?
Yes, he had the Turing test. I'm not right. sure if he invented that or whether mm-hmm. somebody named it after him, but the idea was that if you could set things up so you couldn't tell whether a computer was answering you or a person, then this was passing the Turing test. Mm-hmm. And could we get computers that would be so much like people that we couldn't tell the difference?
Mm-hmm. It was a recent survey in the UK that showed that just 22.5% of new recruits in IT are women.
That's sort of in line with what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
As I said, I think it might be getting a little better. The problem in computer science, I think, mostly arises pre-university and has to do with our culture and what young girls feel about the professions they'd like to go into.
Yeah.
And I think that now that we have Facebook and Twitter and other kinds of social networking, girls may be feeling that computers are a little more like the kinds of things they like to do.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you working on now? What interests you?
Right now, I work in distributed computing, which has to do with applications like Google and eBay and Amazon that provide you services over the network. And typically, these systems run themselves on thousands or tens of thousands of computers.
Is this what we call the cloud these days?
Amazon is producing a kind of storage called cloud computing, and my current research actually is very much focused on online storage. It's very desirable from a personal point of view to be able to put your data online, because then you don't have to be responsible for maintaining it.
Yeah.
Make sure you do backups. You know, what happens if your computer fails and stuff like that.
Don't you feel like you're back in the old mainframe days?
No, because you don't necessarily run on your data there, although Amazon is also producing those kinds of facilities. But just having the ability to not worry about the backup problem is a big boon for users. And the problem is that if you put your data in the cloud, you want to be absolutely certain that it doesn't get lost, that it's there when you need it, and that it isn't compromised in any way. And particularly if you put on confidential information, you want to be sure that it doesn't get leaked.
Yeah,
and so those are the kinds of problems that I'm working on these days.
Those are major problems, worrying about the security of your data.
Yes, they definitely are.
When it goes out into the netherworld someplace.
Right.
And you can't keep track of it. Well, I wish you good luck. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, and congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Barbara Liskov, who just won the Turing Award, it's called the Nobel Prize in Computing. She is Institute Professor and Head of the Programming Methodology Group in the Computer Science and the Artificial Intelligence Lab over there at MIT. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about the mood of science for science in Washington these days. President Obama signed a couple of executive orders this week and talked about restoring science. We'll talk with the new president of the AAAS, Peter Agri, will join us. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.